This is the Rocky Mountain Bible School, 2025. It's Wednesday, June 25th, and our second period speaker is Brother Bill Link, Jr., from the Baltimore, Maryland Ecclesia. His theme this week is Speak Ye Comfortably to Jerusalem, and Class 3 is titled, I Will Defend This City for My Name's Sake.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning.
I think it's a wonderful thing when the presiding brother has to tell everybody to shh, because it means that we are sharing sweet fellowship with one another. That's always the case in the Baltimore meeting. The presiding brother always has to get everybody organized because we're having such sweet fellowship, and that's a good thing. Well, where are we in Isaiah? In the timeline I've put up a few times here before with the events that are highlighted in the book of Isaiah and also a second version of it where I have the chapters. You see that yesterday we spent time with the Ahaz portion of Isaiah. We spent most of our time with chapters 7 to 11 and 12. Today, with great regrets, we have to skip over chapters 13 to 35. Although we will come back and make a few references to it. Chapters 13 to 23 include oracles against Babylon, against Assyria, Philistia, Moab, Tyre and Sidon, and other nations. And the focus that we see in all of this is this Assyrian mob that's coming through, that's going to be afflicting. Interestingly, and I can't skip this one, in chapter 22, there is an oracle of Isaiah reproaching Jerusalem. Because remember, Jerusalem is the focus of the entire book. In chapter 22, that reproaches Jerusalem herself and some of her leaders. And there's one little bit in it that I've got to mention. Have a look at verses 9 to 11. Isaiah here is making reference to something that is mentioned explicitly in Chronicles and in Kings' accounts about the preparations that Hezekiah and the people made because they knew the Assyrians were coming. First of all, they cut off the water supply for the Assyrians. Hezekiah said, no sense in giving them our water. And secondly, they prepared a way for there to be water in the city in case there was a siege. So in Isaiah 22, verses 9 to 11, and I'd like to read this from the New American Standard because I think it expresses it very clearly. It says, you saw that the breaches in the wall of the city of David were many. And you collected the waters of the lower pool. Then you counted the houses of Jerusalem and tore down houses to fortify the wall. And you made a reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool. All these wonderful preparations that Hezekiah and the people did. But listen to this. But you did not depend on him who made it, nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. So it says, you know, you drilled through all that rock, but you're not thinking about the one who made that rock. We'll say more about that in a minute. Now, it's remarkable that one of these conduits for the water into Jerusalem still exists. An American Congregationalist minister documented the full extent of the tunnel in 1838. And one of the things he found out, rather the hard way, was that every 30 minutes, right down to the present day, the Gihon Spring bursts forth, causing the water level to rise slightly. And one of this man's students was a 16-year-old kid who was just very enthusiastic about the work. And he felt his way through this tunnel, and he got halfway through it, and he slipped and fell down. And when he got back up, he reached up and touched above his head, and he found an inscription that had been made there years and way back. And that was a remarkable discovery. There was a plaque that read, and this is the story of the tunnel. While 3 cubits were left, the voice of a man calling to his counterpart. And on the day of the tunnel being finished, the stonecutters struck each man toward his counterpart, axe against axe, and flowed water from the source to the pool for 1,200 cubits. It was an incredible feat that they accomplished. They had gone 550 meters, right? About 3/10 of a mile. And they were 50 meters deep. And they dug from 2 different directions and they almost magically met in the middle to make this tunnel. It was an amazing accomplishment. But the point that Isaiah makes about it is, you know, you feel pretty good about the preparations you've done, but don't let us forget the God who created the rock that you've dug through. So that's a kind of little neat incidental. Unfortunately, we've got to pass lightly over these chapters from 13 to 35. And today our emphasis will be on this central event in the prophecy of Isaiah, the Sennacherib siege and the events that follow after. These divide the book into the Assyria part and the Babylon part. So let's think about Hezekiah. Would you turn up 2 Kings chapter 18 with me? Now it came to pass in the 3rd year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, the son of that brutal, awful Ahaz, that faithless man, Hezekiah began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. Verse 3, he did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. And you skip over Ahaz, his father Ahaz. He was a son of David. He removed the high places and break the images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan. So he worked against idolatry, including even this famous historical artifact. And they'd had that serpent that had been lifted up in the wilderness hundreds of years, but it become an object of superstitious worship. And Hezekiah says, no, doesn't matter how old it is and how big a part it played in our history, it's become corrupted. He got rid of it. Verse 5. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah who were before him. You might notice in your daily readings as we go through this, that it says something similar about Josiah, that there was none like him before or after. But I think the emphasis here, the distinction between Josiah and Hezekiah, is his trust. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel. So the condemnations that we've just sort of read back there in chapter 22 about them not looking to the one who made the rock, I think that's the people that Hezekiah couldn't completely influence all the people, and we'll see some indications of that as we carry on today. Verse 6, for he clave to the Lord and departed not from following him, but kept his commandments which the Lord commanded Moses. I don't know if you've ever noticed this here. It's kind of neat. This is one of the benefits of the good old King James, you know, is sometimes you see a word like clave, and it makes you think back to Genesis. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. Same word. You know, that unity that we have in an ideal marriage in which we strive for always. That was the relationship that Hezekiah had to his God. He departed not from following him. And so it says in verse 7 that God prospered him. One of the things that he did, you'll see there in verse 7, is he rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. Remember that Ahaz, his father, was sending tribute. Well, Hezekiah says, no more. He smote the Philistines, even unto Gaza, and the borders thereof, from the Tower of the Watchman to the fenced city. Now, if we come over to 2 Chronicles, and I think we'll probably spend more in 2 Chronicles, so you might want to look this up and keep a finger there. Or if it's an electronic finger, nowadays that's a bookmark, I guess we call it. 2 Chronicles, we're going to look at chapter 29. Here it says in verse 3, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. So this 25-year-old man who has been there watching what his father Ahaz is doing, corrupting the temple, making a mess of things, it's as though he's chomping at the bit. And he doesn't wait to get other things sorted out. It's the very first day of his reign that he opens the doors of the house of the Lord, begins repairs in the temple. That's described in verses 3 to 19 here. Verses 20 to 36 describe the dedication he makes of the people and of the temple. There's a lot to read there, but I just want us to see, look in particular at the spirit that he managed to stir up among the people. Verse 34 reads like this. There were so many offerings that they brought that the priests were too few, so that they could not flay all the burnt offerings. Wherefore the brethren, their brethren, the Levites, did help them till the work was ended, and until the other priests had sanctified themselves, for the Levites were more upright in heart to sanctify themselves than the priests. Also the burnt offerings were in abundance, with the fat of the peace offerings and the drink offerings for every burnt offering. So the service of the house of the Lord was set in order, and Hezekiah rejoiced, and all the people, that God had prepared the people, for the thing was done suddenly. He was able to bring about an extraordinary reform, and quickly. Chapter 30 is remarkable. This has the reinstitution of the Passover. And I think it's so remarkable that it says there hadn't been such a Passover kept for quite a long time. It says, when he called up north, you would think up in the northern kingdom, those few Jews that were left there, that they were all apostates, they'd all been misled, and you could just write them off. But Hezekiah calls to them and pleads with them to come take part in the Passover. And some mock, but some come. It's an interesting lesson to contemplate. I love this. I love chapter 30 verses. It's a longer section, but I want to read it anyway. Chapter 30 of 2 Chronicles, verses 22 to 27. It says, and Hezekiah spake comfortably unto all the Levites that taught the good knowledge of the Lord. There's a lot there. The good knowledge of the Lord, right? That's what we're getting this week at Bible school. The good knowledge of the Lord. And notice he spoke comfortably to them. That's the same phrase as is used in our theme for the week. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem. It actually means speak to their heart. So Hezekiah spoke to the heart of the Levites. And they ate the feast 7 days, offering peace offerings and making confession to the Lord God of the fathers. And I love this verse 23 of chapter 30. The whole assembly took counsel to keep other 7 days. and they kept other 7 days with gladness. It's as though we here at Rocky Mountain Bible School decided this had been such a good week of Bible school. What say we have another week of it, you know? Imagine the committee would love us if we made that suggestion. Hezekiah gave to the people 1,000 bullocks, 7,000 sheep. The princes gave to the congregation 1,000 bullocks, 10,000 sheep. And a great number of priests sanctified themselves. And all the congregation of Judah with the priests and the Levites and all the congregation that came out of Israel and the strangers that came out of the land of Israel and that dwelt in Judah rejoiced. So there was great joy in Jerusalem. For since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there was not the like in Jerusalem. Then the priests, the Levites, arose and blessed the people. And I love this part. Because so often in the Kings and the Chronicles, the history, we just get the history. We don't get to sort of the heaven's eye perspective of things. But here we do. Their voice was heard. And their prayer came up to his holy dwelling place, even unto heaven. What a remarkable man Hezekiah was. What a remarkable influence he was. It appears that his influence wasn't 100%, but there were some folks who were still doubtful or weak that needed correction. But he'd led the people so far back from where Ahaz had taken them. And now, despite all of that, adversity comes on the nation. And so our focus today will be on chapters 36 to 39. Isaiah 36 takes us to the 14th year of Hezekiah's reigns. The Assyrians had attacked parts of the north in 732 and taken away the northern kingdom. They had taken the northern capital of Samaria in 722. And now, 20 years later, they've made their way to the outskirts of Jerusalem. And 2 Kings chapter 18, in its account of Hezekiah's life, says that this was in response to Hezekiah saying, "We're not paying that tribute anymore." So now the Assyrians say, "Okay, you're not going to pay tribute? Let's see about that." And so they marched down through the land. We've seen in Isaiah chapter 10, the progress of the Assyrian all the way down through all the cities, down to Lachish, and him standing and shaking his fist at Jerusalem. Well, here we have it. Here we have the fulfillment of that prophecy. Hezekiah has a moment of wavering here. First, he gets panicky, I think. It says in the king's account that he tried to buy off the Assyrians with silver and gold from the temple. And it didn't have any effect. Sennacherib remained and expanded his attack. And the Assyrians make it all the way to Lachish in the southwest. And Isaiah chapter 36 describes the sending of a man named Rabshakeh to Jerusalem from Lachish, right? So the king of the Assyrians is over there in Lachish. Remember those panels that we saw? I didn't mention this yesterday. I was being nice to the British among us. But the British went and they sort of looted all that stuff, and now it's in the museums. And sorry. But it's neat that we get to see those things. No, I didn't show you that yesterday. I'm going to show it to you today. Ah, my. Here it is. This is the one. This is a huge. I don't know how in the world they carried this back to the UK. It's 5 meters tall, 12 meters long. That's several big hunks of rock. And on these rocks is a very detailed pictorial account of the Sennacherib siege of Lachish. In fact, here's a detail up here, and you can see in the, let's see if I can point to this, right up here there's the Assyrian language, the cuneiform. I have a real special memory when I was a young child. There was a brother whose name might not be familiar to you. His name was Wilfred Lambert. I thought maybe somebody here was saying, oh yeah, we all know Wilfred Lambert. Anybody know Wilfred Lambert? Brother Wilfred Lambert was actually, he was a really renowned, he has a Wikipedia page, I'm pretty sure, he was an Assyriologist. He was an expert on Assyria. And I can remember when I was a kid, him coming to our house, and my mom had one of these, old Bible archaeological books, and she gave it to him because there was some cuneiform, that's, this stuff up here that the way they wrote, and he took the book and he turns it upside down and then read it to us. Pretty neat memory. But in cuneiform up there, this is what's written. Sennacherib, the mighty king, king of the country of Assyria, sitting on the throne of judgment at the entrance of the city of Lachish, I give permission for its slaughter. So, not a nice person. So, we come to chapter 36. The king of Assyria sends, verse 2, Sennacherib with a great army. And we're going to look closely at chapter 36, so I'm going to turn off the screen for now. Rabshakeh, it says in verse 2, came with a great army to a very public place. In fact, it's the same place as Isaiah had confronted Ahaz 30 years earlier with his son Shear-Jashub. Hezekiah himself is not there, but he has three representatives. In verse 3, there's Eliakim, who's the son of the high priest, Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, who's a chronicler, a record keeper, a historian. And the Rabshakeh, because it might be a title rather than a name, begins to speak. Verse 4, say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? And as we read Rabshakeh's words, this guy is such a politician. He's so dishonest. He's just trying to manipulate. He's just trying to dispirit his audience. Listen to his twisted reasoning. I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they're mere words. Now, on whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Look, you're trusting in this staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. Now, some interesting things about that. You look in the Kings and Chronicles accounts, there's no mention of Hezekiah and the people trusting in Egypt. However, in Isaiah's oracles, chapter 30, verses 1 to 7, and also in chapter 31, 1 to 5, these both strongly support the idea that at least some of the people were looking to Egypt. That's kind of a neat, it's kind of one of these neat, almost undesigned scriptural coincidences. We don't get it in the history accounts, but it is in the oracles of Isaiah in the previous chapters. It seems doubtful that Hezekiah himself was among those trusting in Egypt. But Rabshakeh's words are for the present audience, as will become clear as we read on. Verse 7, but if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar? Rabshakeh's got it all twisted around. He's confusing, he's obscuring, he's obfuscating. Hezekiah had not taken away the altar of the Lord, he'd done the exact opposite. Now, where did Rabshakeh get his information? Brother Harry Whitaker, in his book, Hezekiah the Great, suggests that he may have been a renegade Jew. You notice in verse 11 that we'll get to a little bit later when Hezekiah's men say, hey, listen, don't speak to us in Hebrew. We understand We don't need to have, and no, I didn't do that. I came to speak. He's speaking Hebrew. Also, he uses the language of prophecy in verse, where is that? Just a little bit later on where he says it's verse 16, where he, it's almost like he's quoting Micah about every man under his own vine and fig tree. And he says that he came with the Lord's approval, which seems maybe to be alluding to some of the things we looked at yesterday in Isaiah chapter 10, where he's the rod of God's wrath. Of course, then in a few minutes, he contradicts himself again by saying that the Lord cannot deliver them. That's verses 18 to 20. So then he comes with an offer. He says, look, verse 8. I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses, if you're able to get enough people to even put mouths on those 2,000 horses. So it's a scary situation. Hezekiah's men, Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah, verse 11 say, please speak to your servants in Aramaic. We understand it. Don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. But the Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words and not to the men who sit on the wall who will eat and drink their own waste with you? We come to the end of the chapter, verse 22. And Hezekiah's men come to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and tell him the words of Rabshakeh. Following over into chapter 37, when Hezekiah heard it, he also tore his clothes. He covered himself with sackcloth, and he went into the house of the Lord. And he sends these three men of his, in verse 2, to Isaiah. Now, that's kind of interesting to think about. Hezekiah undoubtedly knew Isaiah from when he was a very young man. There's no question about that. And it might have even been Isaiah's influence, along perhaps also with Hezekiah's mom. We don't know why it was that on the first day of the first year that he set about with all these reformations. But when he has this bad news, Hezekiah right away says, take this to Isaiah. Here's something neat. In the section we've had to skip over are a whole bunch of prophecies against Assyria that Hezekiah undoubtedly knew. Chapter 14, I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. Chapter 29 speaks of Ariel, the Lion of God, Jerusalem, being besieged, but her foes shall be like small dust and like a dream that a hungry man has of being fed, and he wakes up. They're going to disappear that quickly. Chapter 30, verse 31. Through the voice of the Lord shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. Chapter 31, verse 8. Then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword, not of a mighty man, and the sword not of a mean man shall devour him, but he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall be discomfited. And he shall pass over the stronghold for fear, and his princes shall be afraid of the ensign, saith the Lord, whose fire is in Zion and his furnace in Jerusalem. So when Hezekiah's men come back with this fearful news, this great company of men, you know, the king of Assyria is over there besieging Lachish, but he's still able to send a big army with Rabshakeh to have the people shaking in their boots. And they bring the news to Hezekiah, and Hezekiah sends to Isaiah, because Hezekiah knows these things. Hezekiah speaks to his servants in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 6. Isaiah said to them, this is Isaiah speaking to Hezekiah. He says, "Thus you shall say to your master, to Hezekiah, thus saith the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you've heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Surely I will send a spirit upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land." Then Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libnah, for he heard that he departed from Lachish. And the king heard concerning Tirhakah, king of Ethiopia, he's come out to make war with you. So when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah. Just think it's interesting in verses 6 to 9 there to notice things being heard, right? God says through Isaiah, don't be afraid of the words which you've heard. I'm going to send a scare on the king of Assyria. He'll hear a rumor, verse 37. And so Rabshakeh, who's come from Lachish, goes back and he finds that the king's no longer there. He's gone against Libnah, for he has heard that Tirhakah, king of Ethiopia, is coming up from the south. Well, the king of Assyria sends messengers again to Hezekiah in verse 9. And they say in verse 10, "Thus you shall speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Look, you have heard what kings of Assyria have done to all lands by utterly destroying them. And shall you be delivered?" I love verses 14 to 20. Says Hezekiah received the letter, and he read it, and he went up to the house of the Lord, and he spread it out before the Lord. There's something so innocent and even childlike about that. I just love that image, that he takes the letter and he spreads it out. "Here it is, Lord, have a look at it." You know, I mean, sometimes I guess we're so sophisticated, you know, we think, well, we don't need this. But it's like, here it is, Lord, here it is, you know. Childlike faith. And what a prayer he offers. Verses 16 and following in Isaiah 37. "O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. Truly, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations in their lands and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore, they destroyed them. Now, therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hands, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord, you alone. It is for God's reputation that Hezekiah appeals." He doesn't make his appeal based on, we're scared to death, this is an awful thing that's going to happen to us. It's God's reputation that he sees is on the line. And so from verse 21 to 35, we have God's response given through Isaiah. God says, we'll just read a little bit of it. Verse 29, "Because your rage against me and your tumult have come up to my ears, therefore I will put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. In verse 36. Oh, but we can't skip verse 35. For God says, "For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake." God keeps his promises. He keeps his promises. So verse 36 says, "Then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses, all dead." You know, that was an angel. An angel went out that night. I think of Jesus when he says to Peter, "Don't you know that even now I could call 12 legions of angels?" He had such power and authority given to him. An angel went out and wrought all this destruction. Now there's an interesting, well, let's read the rest of it. "So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. Now it came to pass as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that his sons Adrammelech and Sharezer struck him down with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. Then Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead." Oh, historical detail from secular history that we don't get here, but it's kind of interesting to notice it, is that this was 20 years later. So Sennacherib had 20 years to think about how he had failed at Jerusalem before he met his final fate. He tried, like all good politicians, to put a good spin on things. Another great archaeological find, also in the British Museum in London. This one's not nowhere near as big as the last one. This is just about 5.5 inches across and maybe 15 inches tall. It's one of the best preserved Assyrian documents. It's called the Taylor Prism. And I have a little excerpt from it here. He says, "As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities. Himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were leaving his city's gate." But he never says anything about having actually conquered the city, which is a pretty remarkable thing. Now, blanking the screen again. Chapters 36 to 39 of Isaiah sort of dip into a biographical and historical account. And this section doesn't end with the deliverance from Assyria. Instead, Isaiah includes two more episodes from Hezekiah's life: his illness and his recovery, and the subsequent visit of Babylonian ambassadors. And the question is, why are these two incidences included? We can clearly see the importance of the account of the Assyrian rout. But I believe there's a good reason why we have chapters 38 and 39 as well as 36 and 37. While chapters 36 and 37 are the climax of the first part of Isaiah, the Assyria part, chapters 38 and 39 point forward to the second part of Isaiah. In the first part, the looming threat is Assyria, and Ahaz and the nation are called to look beyond Assyria to God's future deliverance. The first part of the book includes a little bit of stuff about Babylon, but the primary emphasis is on Assyria. And by the way, in the early part, when it mentions Babylon, that's because Babylon was part of Assyria, and so it's not the Babylon that we have later on. The first part's definitely all Babylon. The latter part is all the Assyrian. In fact, 43 of 44 references to Assyria are in chapters 1 to 37, and the remaining one is retrospective. It's looking back. All right, so let's briefly summarize chapters 38 and 39. Chapter 38 has Hezekiah's illness and his cure. Chapter 39 has the extension, or sorry, chapter 38, he's about to die, but he prays for an extension of life. He's given another 15 years, which is kind of interesting. He reigned 29 years, and if you had an extension of, okay, a little bit of math work for you here. If he reigned 29 years and he had an extension of 15 years, his illness was in his 14th year, right? And it was in the 14th year that Sennacherib came up. And so Hezekiah's illness is at the very least in the same year. A good argument can be made that it is actually contemporary with the events of the Assyrian siege. That might actually explain why Hezekiah wasn't there when Rabshakeh spoke. Say a little bit more about that in a minute. So let's have a look at chapter 38. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death. What was his illness? Well, in verse 21, it speaks of a boil, a nasty, ulcerated sore. It's actually the same word that's used in Leviticus of leprosy. It's the same word that's used in Job of his affliction, and that was arguably elephantiasis. Whatever it was painful and it was fatal. And so it says in verse 2 that Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall. Isaiah had come and told him, "You're not going to live." Isaiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed to the Lord. Isaiah had said to him, "You're not going to survive this one." Hezekiah could have just said, "Well, that's the way it is. I give up." But no, he turns his face toward the wall and prays a beautiful prayer. Verses 2 and 3. Hezekiah said, "Remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I've walked before you in truth with a loyal heart, and have done what's good in your sight." And he wept bitterly. And Isaiah sent back in verse 4. "Go and tell Hezekiah, thus says the Lord, the God of David your father, I've heard your prayer, I've seen your tears. Surely I will add to your days 15 years. I will deliver you in this city from the hand of the king of Assyria." So there's another indication that Hezekiah's illness was contemporary with the Assyrian siege. "I will defend this city. And this is the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing which he has spoken. Behold, I'll bring the shadow on the sundial, which has gone down with the sun on the sundial of Ahaz, 10 degrees backward." This is a compressed account of what we have in the Kings, where he was actually offered, "All right, do you want the shadow to go forward or backward 10 degrees? And Hezekiah says, "Well, forward, that seems maybe easier. Backward, that seems impossible. We'll go with backward." Remember how old Ahaz, he wouldn't ask for a sign. Hezekiah, God gives him a sign. Hezekiah responds. How did that happen? How could you possibly have the shadow from the sundial go backward? The only way it could happen would be to have a light brighter than the sun, right? A light brighter, can you think of an example of a light brighter than the sun in the scriptures? The Shekinah glory. But specifically when? With the Apostle Paul on the road to Damascus, right? There's this brilliant light, brighter than the sun. It actually says that in Acts. So Acts 26, 13, "At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven brighter than the sun." And that's, I think, what happened. And so the chapter ends, chapter 38 ends with this magnificent prayer of thankfulness. "I said," verse 10, "in the prime of my life, I shall go to the gates of Sheol. I'm deprived of the remainder of my years." Verse 12, "my lifespan is gone." Verse 14, "like a crane or a swallow, so I chattered. I mourned like a dove." And he says, he's so thankful. Verse 17, you have cast all my sins behind your back. Sheol cannot thank you. Death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your truth. The living man, he shall praise you as I do this day. The Father shall make known your truth to the children. And so he's spared. And he has 15 years of his life, an extension of life. Well, we come over to chapter 39. And it says that at that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that he had been sick and had recovered. Babylon was a city in the Assyrian Empire. And it sort of waxed and waned through the years. And at this point, it is exploding in power and will eventually overwhelm the whole Assyrian Empire. So the king of Babylon sends letters and a present. And it says here in chapter 39, verse 1, that he heard that Hezekiah had been sick and that he recovered. Interesting, in the Chronicles account, it adds this detail that he came to ask about the miraculous sign that had occurred in the land. The Babylonians were big-time astronomers. And if they heard about the sundial going back, it sounds like that in 2 Chronicles account. And in fact, there's even a Wikipedia entry on Babylonian astronomy. I mean, it was a big deal. And so he heard that there was another sign, an even bigger sign maybe, that, for the king of Babylon, who's got his own ambitions. And that's like, what happened to this 185,000 Assyrians? And so he's thinking, maybe we better be friends with these folks down there in Judah. So he sends ambassadors. And Hezekiah was pleased, it says in chapter 39, verse 2. He showed them the house of his treasures, the silver and the gold, the spice and precious ointment, all his armory, all that's found among the treasures. There's nothing that he didn't show him. And I could sort of imagine, I could understand Hezekiah, because he's saying, look at how good God's been to me. And it's in his enthusiasm for God's salvation. And maybe that's the way they approached him. His exuberance is deeply understandable. He maybe even sought to give God. Maybe he was thinking of Solomon with the king of Queen of Sheba. But there's a hint in Chronicles that God was putting this as a test, because it says God left him to test him and to know everything that was in his heart. And so after the Babylonian folks leave, verse 3, Isaiah the prophet goes to King Hezekiah and said, tell me what happened. And Isaiah tells him everything. Hezekiah tells him everything. And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they shall take away of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Ever feel uneasy with what Hezekiah says in verse 8? I've struggled with this verse. Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you've spoken is good, for he said, at least there will be peace and truth in my days. Oh. It seems a bit unworthy, doesn't it? It seems like he's saying, well, if there's going to be problems, at least I don't have to deal with it. It's be somebody else's problem. That doesn't seem quite in character for Hezekiah. So I have another idea. We have in the prophecy of Micah that we've spoken about once or twice, a time where God is angry with Israel, or Judah, and he warns them, and they repent, and God relents. Maybe Hezekiah is saying, the fact that punishment is not coming right now means that there will be time for reformation. Maybe that was his hope. It's not going to happen right now. Now, one way or the other, this chapter 39 serves then as the introduction to what will follow in the remaining chapters. In chapters 1 to 35, the Assyrian threat provides the background for the prophecy. Chapters 36 and 37 show God's deliverance from that threat. Chapters 38 to 39 provide a bridge to the latter part of Isaiah, where the future Babylonian threat that's well beyond Hezekiah's days it's so certain to come, the Babylonian threat is so certain to come, that it's spoken of as already having taken place. But the deliverance from Babylon that is to come is set as the backdrop for God's ultimate redemption of Israel and of the world. And so tomorrow, we have a real feast of fat things. It's the righteous servant. We're going to look at the righteous servant in chapters 40 to 66. And I can't wait to do it.